I'm very happy to be speaking to an Irish gathering because there's a bit of Irish in me. And the very first time I came to Ireland, which I think was 1983, I remember feeling when the plane landed in Dublin that I was coming home as and home to myself in a way, and home to the my roots, because I had two Irish grandmothers. Well, they were sort of Scottish Irish, one from Derry and the other one from Moville at the other side of the border in Donegal. And I feel sort of epigenetically linked to the island of Ireland, and I don't think that will ever go away. And been to Ireland quite a few times, and one of the most memorable experiences was, I think it was about 1986, when I was at the Soil Association, and we developed the organic standards, the very first draft of the organic standards. And I was involved with writing them because I was a dairy farmer, and there were no livestock standards at that time. And Irish Organic Farmers and Growers Association, IOFCA, were wanting to launch a certification scheme. So they invited me and another guy called Gareth Rowlands over to kind of pump prime the IOFCA inspection service. We had an incredible time. And then over the succeeding years, we participated in some amazing parties, some of which were in castles. And then there was one at the Glencree Centre of Peace and Reconciliation. And I just remember this, the crack and the amazing spirit of those events. And that sort of bonded me even more to Ireland. And I feel very connected. And the other thing I wanted to say was that although I've never been to the Barron, a man called Dennis Healy, who was one of the early people in, he was an organic grower, one of the early organic growers in Ireland. He sent a tape, an old cassette tape of a talk that he had been to in a school hall in the Barron, given by John O'Donoghue. And he sent it to a friend of mine called Peter Seger, who was also involved in the very early days of the development of the Irish organic movement. And he came to me and he said, "You must listen to this tape, it's incredible." And the talk was called Stone as the Tabernacle of Memory. And the talk was really about how landscape holds cultural memoria. And it was the most stunning and beautiful talk, which just completely captivated me. I listened to it many times and I've still got a copy. And I know Prince Charles and I sent him a copy because I thought he'd like it. And I heard nothing back. I just posted it to him. And then about 2 months later, I had a note from him and he said, "I finally got round to listening to this talk. Who is this man, John O'Donoghue? He's a remarkable man and I'd like to meet him." And then they did meet and of course got to know each other and developed a bit of a friendship, I think. And then of course he died and was taken from us. But the words of that talk and also the writings, his writings, I think have been a significant influence on me. And I remember he described the Barron as a stone landscape. And when you get up to the top of the hill, there's another horizon. And then he talks about how landscape is cultural memoria and it holds out against transience. And to the sensitive person, the record of everything that happened on a landscape is recorded in it. And then he goes into a house and he says, you know, the atmosphere of a house, the stones of a house hold the memory of every event that happened in the place. And those kind of ideas just, I knew that I felt the truth of them immediately. And so he's been a very major influence on me. So I thought it would just be good to acknowledge that. And then the other story I briefly like to tell is that my grandmother, my mother's mother, was a Jemison, but her mother was a Wallis. And her second cousin, I think it was a guy called Henry Wallis, whose father or grandfather had gone out to America. And Henry Wallis became the agricultural secretary, and he was the founder of the Pioneer Seeds Company, and he became vice president, and then I think he was very nearly president, but he wasn't. But the interesting bit about it was that he fell in love with my grandmother when he came back to Ireland. I think this was around 1915 or something like that, and proposed to her, apparently. And she turned him down. And I think she said on her deathbed that, you know, if she'd accepted that proposal, then things could have gone a very different way. So I love that story. I love those kind of personal stories that link one back to places that one perhaps has never known personally. So my story is that I grew up in London. My dad was a child psychiatrist, and we used to go on childhood holidays, and I had glimpses of nature. I fell in love with the Hebridean Islands and the Scottish West Highlands, and we went on holiday in Cornwall and Devon and various farming places. And as a result of that, these impressions of nature really stuck with me. And I used to dig ponds in London gardens and watch the pond life and marvel at the ecosystems that very quickly develop in a pond, even if you put nothing in it to start with. It all comes naturally. And I realized, without understanding or putting words on it, that when you look in a pond like that, you are witnessing in microcosm the ecosystem of nature. And various other influences fell upon me, including my dad going to Stanford University in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1970, and me joining for a 6 or 9 months out there with him and my family. And I came back to England in 1971, convinced that the most important thing to do, having had my London childhood, was to get back to the land and set up a rural community, because we were on the edge of an ecological breakdown, and, you know, food would be scarce, and we just needed to be self-sufficient and live the good life. And obviously the timing was very out, but I think the instinct was right. So I was a sort of early reverse urban migrant. And I arrived here in West Wales in 1973 with six other people. We bought a farm and we set up a sort of rural commune. The farm was 135 acres, and our aspiration was to be self-sufficient, produce a surplus of food, farm in a sustainable way, and live happily ever after. And the commune lasted about 18 months, and then gradually sort of things fell apart. But me and my first wife stayed here at the farm, and unfortunately, it was put on the market because two of the other communards were connected with the family that bought the farm for us. So then there was a guy who was staying as a kind of woofer when the first couple left. And he said, I've inherited some money from my grandfather, so I'll buy the farm from the ex-communards and give you a tenancy. So there are various chapters of my occupancy of this place, but the first one was the hippie commune. The second one was a tenant of my friend who wanted to go to London to make films. Then he wanted to come back to the farm, by which time it was the early 80s, and I was starting to get involved with the Soil Association on a voluntary basis. And he said, I'd like to come back and join the farm with you. So we did a deal, and I became a part owner of this place and did my day job for the Soil Association for the next 15 years in Bristol and all over the place. And then I came back at weekends and milked the cows, and we shared the management of the place. That lasted until around 2003, when Nick, my partner, said he wanted to sell up. So I had to raise enough money to buy the farm, which I did from an ethical bank called Triodos Bank, and then borrowed a lot more money to build the infrastructure of the farm, improve the buildings, put up a cheese dairy, and generally try to make the place more self-sufficient and following the principles of the circular economy and, more recently, regenerative farming principles, to farm in harmony with nature, to manage the small parcel of natural capital that I've been lucky enough to have stewardship over, very briefly, I now realize, because life is so short, and hopefully produce as much high quality food as possible from this land, whilst at the same time maintaining the biodiversity, the soil health, the human capital and skills, and the magic and the atmosphere of the place, and hopefully building it as well. And I believe that that is the real function of all food producers, whatever scale we operate on, whether it's in a garden or a small holding or a bigger farm, that we have to farm in harmony with nature, manage the ecosystems, which we kind of have dominion over, but in a sensitive and, you know, respectful way, but at the same time produce food, good food, to feed what is now a very large global population. And I'd like to speak a little bit later about the challenges that we face in relation to that. But I thought I would start, if it's okay, if we could put the screen share thing on now, and just to run through some pictures, because you know, it's easier to imagine, it's possible to imagine what we're doing, it's probably easier to see it. So this first picture is a picture of me on the hill. We're at 750 feet up above sea level, just in from Aberaeron on the Cardigan Bay coast. So behind my head and along another 70 miles to the west is, of course, the Irish coast. And we've been here since 73, and those cows are descended, mostly Ayrshires, there's a few crosses there, but they're mostly descended from the original cows we bought in 1973. Next, please. And there is me in the hippie days with long hair, dark then, and an International B276 tractor and a mixture of aluminium and cast iron milk churns, the milk from the cows in the background were our foundation cows. This was taken in 1973, and I was on the way down to the bottom of the drive to put the churns on the milk stand. Next, please. There's the farm. Actually, it was taken in the spring during that incredible dry spell. Today, ahead of us is the stable house where the horses used to be, and to the right is the milking parlour, and then, of course, to the left, the house. And this is just, must have been, I think, the very last days of April when the beech trees were coming out. We're quite high, as I said, so it's a bit of a late spring with us. Over next, please. And there is the there are the buildings, nearly all of those buildings we've put up since we arrived. In the foreground, there's the cheese dairy and the store. Behind that, there's a silo. We try to be self-sufficient for feed the cows, so we grow oats and peas. We put them in the silo then that's poking its nose above the cheese dairy. And then in the middle, the buildings where we house the cattle in the winter. To the left, the other end of the milking parlour. And there's another smaller silo where if we do buy in any concentrates for the cows, we put it in there. Next, please. And here we've been building. We get at the moment, we're capitalising on the last of the EU money due to the unfortunate occurrence of Brexit, which I apologise for profoundly on behalf of the whole of the United Kingdom. This is a silo we put up with a 40% grant, and it's now full of silage. And to the right is a store where we compost all our muck, our farmyard manure. I very recently was at Ballymaloe Cookery School with Tim Allen, and he's doing a similar thing. And I think there needs to be a new tradition of composting animal manures, which is not very frequently done on livestock farms. Next, please. There's our dairy herd coming for milking. That's the new silo, courtesy of the EU funding. And on the opposite hill, rather sadly, we missed out on buying that land, and instead it's growing crops for a biomass digester, which I think is just awful, really. And you can't blame the farmer, if you like, because he's just following the money. But it just seems to me that growing crops for quite intensively for energy production just seems mad to me. So the next, please. This is a picture of a woman called Dame Glenys Stacey, who was put in charge of doing a regulatory review of the certification system and the audits that farmers have to have by Michael Gove when he was DEFRA secretary. She came from the probation service, but she was a very bright woman. She came to see us, and the guy on my right is a man called John Westlake, and he's writing the new Welsh agricultural policy, and I'll refer to that later. In the background is a circular manure store with a covered gas-tight roof, because we have ambitions to produce electricity, probably hot water from the gas emissions from our slurry in that store. Thank you. Next, please. And here's a holding called Havod, Hafod is Welsh for summer place, and these are our in-calf heifers having a wonderful summer holiday down there. It floods in the winter, but in the summer it's just very idyllic, and we rear our heifers there. Thank you. Next. And here's another picture of the same field in the first slide, in a more dry state, looking towards the coast. The sea is just over the hill on the horizon. Thank you. And here we're practicing the principles of regenerative grazing, and you probably know about that, but basically the essence of it is that all plants need to maintain an above and a below ground ratio of biomass. And when you cut a hay meadow or a silage meadow, or just if you graze grass or cut the lawn, it's noticeable how the grass grows back very quickly. And that's because it's trying to restore its above ground biomass. But if you have cattle in the same field for a week or two, they keep on eating it because that's the way that cows graze. They could take one bite here and one bite there, and then they come back again. And by the time the grass has been grazed half a dozen or a dozen times, it realizes that it can't re-establish its biomass below ground. So it sheds roots, which makes the pastures inherently less productive. So if you graze intensively, like people like Alan Savory or Joel Salatin have observed and learned from, and then you move the cows on after 24 hours, you get a much more productive pasture. So we are applying those principles on the farm. And in order to do so, you need to divide up the fields, because we haven't got a big enough herd to just graze one field and move on, with electric fencing of one kind or another. And you also need to put tracks in. This track didn't exist 4 years ago, and it's paved with this stone from our hill, and also water, because otherwise you can't manage the land in this way. Here are the cows coming into milking. Next, please. And there's just another shot of the cows in a green lane in May. I think it was this year. Next, please. And of our 300 acres, because we rent land now, we rent more land than we own, that we farm, around half of it is too wet or too steep or too difficult to plow. So that leaves approximately 150 acres. And on that 150 acres, we've got a 7-year rotation. And the 7 years are mostly grass and clover to build fertility, because we are too fragile to have more than two arable crops in a row, because of all the conditions I just described. So what we do is we grow oats, peas and barley, or oats and peas. We used to grow vegetables, we don't anymore, because we couldn't make it work because of the supermarket's policy of centralizing all their packing operations. But when we do grow the crops, we break up the lay. This is the second cereal crop, if you see what I mean. And we sow the crops and we combine them. Move on again, please, twice. And there's the crop coming up, and again, and here's the crop, the same field on a dawn of a spring morning. And then again on, I'm not sure what we've got. This is a bit of a break up. There's another picture of the crop later, but this is what we sow, under sow with arable silage, which is a similar mix, but more foragey. After we've had the 2 years of oats and peas, which we combine and store for the cows and mill them every day in a kind of cow's muesli. This is red clover, white clover, chicory, yarrow, sheep's parsley, you know, burnet. In other words, a herbal lay with also white clover and a range of grasses, some rye grasses, but also coxwort and all sorts of other grasses. Because we think that the diversity of the lay is the key to building soil fertility. And we cut these mostly for silage because it rains a lot where we are and it's difficult to make hay, although we do make hay. But we are opportunistic, and the staple food for the cows in winter is silage topped up with hay, depending on how much we've made. And on again, please. Here's the cereal crop further on. You can see, if you look there in the foreground, there's barley, there are peas and there are oats. This doesn't normally become combinable until early September. And then we obviously bale the straw because we're also more or less self-sufficient in bedding. Next, please. And here's the crop nearly ripe. This was not this year, but last year during that intense drought. And as you can see, the beech trees are losing their leaves, even though it was only late July. It was really a strong drought for us that year. Next, please. And there's the straw in a pole barn that we put up with the remains of our cubicle shed that we put up in 1978. And we put that in a shredder and bed the cubicles and the pens for the young stock every day in the winter. Next, please. Oh, you can see the ash dieback in the background there, by the way. The ash dieback is affecting us, and I think we're going to lose all our ashes within 2 or 3 years. It looks like that anyway. Here's the cows being buffer-fed hay. I think this is in the early spring when they were out at grass, but we like to feed them a bit of hay at milking time because we're making cheese and we want to maintain a sort of fairly consistent milk. And if they have a bit of hay, it just makes the milk more reliable and solid. It's that's what we've experienced anyway, because otherwise the grass can vary a lot from field to field and more or less fiber. Thank you, next. And we suckle our heifer calves. We believe that breast is best or udder is best. And that if you suckle a calf for at least 12 weeks, more often than not, 14, sometimes fostered, sometimes their own calf. And obviously some cows will take to this and some cows won't, but they get a better start and they're loved by their mums or their foster mums. And you can just see the difference in vitality, and I'm sure they get less sick and they live longer. Thank you, next. And here's me in our milking parlor. Rachel's Dairy make yogurt, and the founder of Rachel's Dairy is a woman called Rachel Rowlands, but they went out of milk, so they gave us their old milking parlour. So this is a 10 abreast milking parlour, just very traditional. I think we might even be the third owner, but we're still milking in it. We've kind of vaguely thought about, you know, other systems like a herringbone parlour or even robots in the winter, but I don't think we're going to go there because I think there's something about the intimacy of contact with cows, which is very nourishing to the person who milks, but also important for our relationship with the animals. Next, please. And here's the cheese making operation. This is in the vat, which used to be the Montgomery's vat. Montgomery's is a very well-known cheese maker down in Somerset. And we inherited one of their old vats. But actually when COVID struck, we couldn't have two people making the cheese. So we went back to a Dutch vat, which one person could operate. And it's working very well. And we recently went, as I said, to once a day milking, which we may change back to because now we're now short of cheese because we stopped making it during COVID. Next, please. And here's some visitors to the dairy. And there's the cheese in the molds, just having been through the mill. The cheese we make is called Havod. It's raw milk, unless we're closed down with TB, which most of the time recently we haven't been, although we do make some pasteurized cheese because we're selling it to Australia and the Australians won't buy it unless it's pasteurized because it's their law. But it's made with a traditional complex starter culture, not one of these aggressive cheese starter cultures, which is responsible for more or less all the cheese that is sold in supermarkets today. It isn't even really cheddar, it's kind of different, but everyone thinks it is. And the cheese making process starts at 6:30 in the morning. It goes right through till about 5 in the evening. So it's kind of slow cheddar, like slow bread or, you know, slow everything. Next, please. And here's the cheddaring process and just in the sort of advanced stages. And then it's going through the mill. And then we've gone the wrong way around. Then it goes into the molds. The molds are 10 kilograms. And that's the pasteurizer in the background on the right, which we're not using at the moment. Next. And there's Becky, my wife, wearing a Ballymaloe cookery school top. And the guy next to her is Albert Strauss, who runs an organic dairy, which produces yogurt and milk in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he's become a good friend over the years. We did a conference in San Francisco called The True Cost of American Food in 2016, but I've known him much longer than that. And it's very interesting how even though he's on the other side of the world in a very fragile Californian climate in Marin County, there's so much that we share as farmers. We face so many of the same problems, even though we've got very, very different climates. Next, please. And there is Havod for sale in Byright, which is a whole food shop in San Francisco. I love seeing that because it's as if the cheese is a carrier of the place. It smells like this farm. It is the farm, it's the terroir principle. And it sort of relates to the John O'Donohue, you know, the essence of place somehow is in the cheese. And for me, that's a very moving thing to see it, the other side of the world, still sort of retaining something, even though it's been all over the place by ship and stored and everything. Next, please. Yes, I did used to be a carrot grower. We used to grow a lot of carrots as part of the rotation, but we couldn't make it work, as I said, because the pack house was in, eventually in, the supermarkets had a policy of centralizing all their production systems. So if you go into a supermarket today, just about everything in that supermarket probably would have been slaughtered or processed or packed or distributed from one center. And the carrots we used to grow went to mainly Waitrose and Sainsbury's. And they're originally packed in a pack house on the farm, actually. And then through this progressive policy, they closed down all the pack houses in West Britain and Wales. And eventually there was only one pack house, which now supplies all the carrots to Waitrose and Sainsbury's. And that was situated in Peterborough, 230 miles away from the farm. So we had to give up. And we only grow carrots now. Those carrots are now just for the local market because we just can't get them to market anymore. Next, please. This is barely legal, but it's for home consumption, so it's okay. These are veal animals. We rear our male calves and hang them for 4 weeks in the winter in a barn and then produce have them cut there and produce wonderful ruby veal, which we love. And that's what we do there. Although we've now got a relationship with the local slaughterhouse, and we're managing to start to supply people further afield because we haven't got a license to process on the farm. And in any way, home kills are only allowed for home consumption. Next, please. There's another picture on again. This is our pond. We swim in it every day. It's spring fed. And this really goes back to my roots of my love of nature and the ecosystem. And I was having a conversation on the podcast with James Rebanks very recently, who's inherited the tradition of his forefathers. And he is first and foremost, I'd say, a farmer, but he also has been influenced a lot by the rewilding debate. And for me, I think the most important thing is to farm and produce food, but I recognize that maybe I've been a bit too influenced by just the priority of producing food and maybe need to push it back a bit so that there are more wild places on the farm. This is one of them. I love coming here because when you're in this place surrounded by wildflowers and insects and bats and dragonflies and damselflies, it is an amazing place. And you realize how quickly nature can just, it's so resilient and all these things have just come. We've virtually done nothing except just create the space. Next. And there's a frog in my hand, and I think this might be the last one, and it better be really, because I've got some other stuff that I want to say. So is the next one just the Sustainable Food Trust thing? Well, those tadpoles, yeah, that's lovely too. And the next, damsel flies mating, how beautiful. These are pictures taken by a guy called Richard Dunn, who is putting the harmony principles into practice in schools, and I'll mention that later. So maybe we should stick with the damselflies mating, because I think that's the last one, and just talk about what I do. Oh yeah, this is the guys from the Welsh government visiting the farm, because they're rewriting, as I said, the agricultural policy, which is what I want to speak about. Maybe I'll just speak about that briefly now. Brexit has precipitated the need for all agricultural policy to be changed. And most, the DEFRA have spent 3 years or whatever it is now, in a complete mess, influenced a lot by the environmental organizations who said, we have to separate nature from farming and have wildlife reserves around the edge of otherwise intensively farmed land. And the DEFRA people are more or less just listening to the conservation organizations who think that the way to go ahead after Brexit is just to put more land into stewardship. And I feel, and luckily these guys also feel, this is profoundly wrong, because I remember that when I was a boy in the 50s and 60s, farming did coexist with nature, and there was an abundance of wildlife in the fields because there was no nitrogen fertilizer used and chemicals used on the land. And it was incredible how much could coexist, whether it was in cereal crops or grassland and wildflower meadows, with a low intensity farming system. But unfortunately, all the devolved nations, with the exception of Wales, have kind of drunk that Kool-Aid. But the Welsh guys have designed and are about to launch a truly regenerative farming scheme. So essentially, that's going to reward farmers for producing what Michael Gove referred to as public goods, which of course includes biodiversity, but also soil carbon, reduced emissions, higher quality water, and hopefully more nutrient-dense food. And they're looking for metrics to measure this, and all the farms entering the Welsh scheme will have to have an annual sustainability audit, which is something that we've been working on, the Sustainable Food Trust. We'd love it to come to Ireland as well. And this measures 10 categories of sustainability outcomes, each with a few metrics which are all farmer friendly. And I know you're doing something similar to this in the Baron, and we should join forces on that because it's clear we have common cause. So I better move on and just talk about the Soil Association briefly. I started working for the Soil Association in the late 80s, and then I worked right through until 2010. And when I got to the end of my time at the Soil Association, during which period I'd been involved with developing the organic standards and the organic market, and the reason we did that was because we could see that to stay economically viable in a situation where the polluter didn't pay and the subsidies were misdirected, we needed to get more money for our products. And we could only do that if we told our story to the public and took our message to the public and asked them to pay a bit more for the food. And you could argue that on one level, that was an incredibly successful time because the market grew and, you know, started with nothing and now it's billions in the UK. But actually from another perspective, we were treating the symptoms, not the cause of the problem. Because by creating a niche separate market, we not only polarized the farming community because it was like, either you're organic, in which case you're sort of good, and if you're not organic, you're by inference not good, or we made organic food, proper nutrient-dense food, look expensive and niche, and therefore mainstream food was cheap and accessible, and that created another problem, which we definitely didn't intend to create, but it happened. And meanwhile, climate change was happening, resource depletion was happening, industrial farming was growing, and we became a marginal part of the total food market. And that was one of the reasons why I decided to leave the Soil Association in 2010 and set up a new organization, because I felt that I'd been responsible for developing a non-inclusive farming system, which was polarizing people, as I said, and not addressing the new emergent problems, which are clearly climate change, biodiversity loss, growing food insecurity, damage to public health, and all the things that we now know are threatening our children's lives and indeed the future of humanity on the planet. So it became clear to me that unless we developed some sort of economic and policy environment where most farmers could switch to regenerative farming systems, we weren't going to have a planet that was fit to live on. And something that a woman called Vandana Shiva, who's an Indian campaigner, said last year at a meeting, a talk I heard her give, she said, you know, we used to be thinking about saving the last remnants of pristine wilderness. And that was fine then. But now if you look at the surface of the habitable bit of planet Earth, most of the pristine wilderness is gone and it's all farmed, small or large farms. But the future of reversing climate change and biodiversity loss has to lie mostly in the way we farm. So unless we create conditions where it becomes more profitable to farm in a climate-friendly, biodiversity-friendly, nutrient-dense food-promoting way, we're just going to follow on towards a desperate cliff edge, which we're pretty close to, arguably we're 1.5 to 2 degrees now, and it's probably going to go to 3 if we're not careful. So we perhaps have a decade at the most to put into place a system of economic incentives and disincentives and policy measures which enable that, so that the balance of financial advantage switches towards regenerative and sustainable farming, and farming systems which pollute, damage human health, destroy biodiversity, contribute to climate change, become unprofitable. So that's really the mission of the Sustainable Food Trust, to accelerate the transition towards more sustainable food systems. And in advocating that mission, we see 3 or 4 major barriers to change. The first one I've referred to is the money. it doesn't pay as well to farm in a sustainable way as it does to produce food in ways which cause damage to the environment and human health. That has to be wrong. And to redress that, we need the application of the polluter pays principle, and we need the redirection of subsidies. And we need this to happen pretty soon. And in that respect, Brexit, weirdly, which I was completely opposed to and horrified by, has created an opportunity for the United Kingdom to start to redesign the policy. And as I mentioned, the Welsh policy is really brilliant, but due to the kind of feudal disputes between the various bits of the United Kingdom, there's no guarantee that DEFRA will pick up on what the Welsh are doing, although, of course, we're trying to do that. The second thing, of course, is, well, part of the money problem is not only to introduce the polluter pays principle. So, for instance, nitrogen users ought to be financially responsible for the damage that the fertilisers do. That's obvious, but it hasn't happened. But we also need to redirect the subsidies not towards stewardship. I know that's a controversial thing to say, but I think we need, obviously, we need wild places, but we also need sustainable and regenerative farming to pay. So we think the majority of the single farm payment, the kind of social security payment that all farmers in the EU get just for having an acre of land, should be redirected towards only supporting regenerative farming systems. And that way, we're going to switch the balance of advantage towards financial advantages. The second barrier to change that we think exists is that there are so many different ways of measuring sustainability, these sustainability assessment tools. There are more than 100 in the world, and also overlapping certification schemes, which are enormously confusing to the consumer. So we have about 5 audits a year on this farm. We have Red Tractor. We have 2 organic audits, one for the cheese and one for the farm. We have the Welsh government who want to get data to see if we're eligible for subsidies. We have retail audits and processing audits, and all of them are expensive, time-consuming, and none of them tell me whether we've got more soil organic matter than last year, or more earthworms, or more biodiversity, whether it's bats, bees, unsown plants in the crops, anything, or less emissions, or purer water, or better nutrient cycling with less leaching, or healthier animals. None of these measures are part of the metrics for the sustainability audits. So we thought, we being a group of regenerative, organic and intensive farmers who formed a kind of group about 5 years ago, since we're all subject to these audits, they cost us a lot of money and they don't tell us what we need to know, why don't we take it upon ourselves to develop a harmonised framework for auditing farm sustainability? And why don't we think about that, not in a UK sense, but in a global sense, so that we can develop a common language for sustainability assessment. So you could go anywhere in the world, you could go to Zimbabwe, you could go to Australia, you could go to America, and you would meet a farmer there, and that farmer could use the same metrics to measure their sustainability. Then we would be able to have a kind of Paris Agreement for food and say, right, let's reward farmers for being soil carbon stewards, and we've got common metrics, and then you can have an agreement with countries signing up along the lines of the French catch per meal, 4 per 1,000 initiative, which the French minister, Stéphane Le Foll, launched at the COP21. That would be really something if that happened. And the last barrier to change that I want, we're making amazing progress on that. I think I'm running out of time, so I better, you know, we can talk about that later if you want, but we'd love to build a bridge and have a pilot in Ireland, if anybody's up for that. The last barrier to change, we think, is public confusion about what to eat to be healthy and sustainable. And the Eat Lancet report, which came out a year or so ago, has been massively influential in persuading the public that they ought to move to a plant-based diet, that ruminant meat in particular is bad because of the methane emissions, and that soya, palm oil, coconut oil, and all the other plant fats that we're importing from all over the world at the expense of the destruction of the rainforest is somehow better for us to eat than the fat of the land from grass-fed or mainly grass-fed ruminant animals. And we think that this misinformation needs to be countered. It's not that we want to tell vegetarians that they shouldn't eat a vegetarian diet if they have ethical objections to eating livestock products. But for people who don't have ethical objections, we think there's an environmental case to be made that many of the most fertile soils on the planet have been built through an interaction of ruminants and grass. And that interaction does build soil. And we as farmers can speed up the building of soil, as I described in the slides. And what we really need is not only a revolution of regenerative farming, but also a revolution of public awareness, so that we can have informed members of the public who understand the incredible complexity of food systems in a really simple and accessible and life-enhancing way, so that they can exercise their buying power and their electoral power to make this a political issue, because it is a political issue, because we have not many years to reverse the terrible declines in biodiversity and the relentless growth of greenhouse gas emissions. And a hell of a lot of those come from farming and food systems in one form or another. I just would like to end, if I may. I know, I think I've gone on for 45 minutes, and I apologize for that.
You're fine, Patrick, keep going.
One other thing I want to say is that about 10 years ago, Prince Charles wrote a book called Harmony, A New Way of Looking at Our World. And in this book, which I read and rather dismissed at the time, the prince argues that since the Enlightenment, we've had this kind of separated ourselves and our egos and our relationship with the planet from nature, as if we've had dominion over nature in a sort of wrong dominant way, not stewardship over nature. And we behaved in an arrogant and exploitative manner, as if we could just dine out on the resources of planet Earth for our own purposes. And it's, to me, abundantly clear that that chapter is coming to an end. And we need to find a new relationship between ourselves and nature. And this is a shift of consciousness and not just of attitude that is required. And for me, quite recently, looking at the philosophy and the principles of harmony, which are really derived not from the prince himself, but from his own intuition and his observations about the geometric and mathematical laws that inform just about everything in the universe, including the construction of our own bodies. We need to become more mindful of those principles and laws operating on our own farms. So I've been farming, or trying to farm, in a regenerative way now for a long time, nearly 50 years here on the farm, but I've never really looked at the farm consciously in that way. And I'm just in the process of writing a book about this with a man called Richard Dunn, who's put these principles into practice in the education system, as I briefly mentioned. But in my view, if you start looking at your own farm in a different way, you can see these principles manifesting everywhere, whether it's in the cycles of the year and the rotation of crops, all the kind of different seasons, the life of a person even. These are all cycles. You can see them manifesting. Or if you look at the structure of flowers and the leaves of plants, the Fibonacci sequence is at work everywhere. All these mathematical and geometric laws are manifesting. And of course, they are revealed in the construction of cathedrals and in the application of the principle of the golden ratio and construction of houses and all that sort of thing as well. It's a lifelong study, but I believe that it's related to a kind of consciousness shift that is needed in the world at the present time. I came from the 60s. There was definitely a consciousness shift going on then. And I think there's another one going on now, and it's much needed. And I feel part of that. And I feel excited that if this shift permeates our consciousness as well as our actions in the next few years, then the world that we can co-create to replace the kind of world we've grown up in and are living in at the moment could be truly remarkable and absolutely fulfilling to live in. And I think that is our responsibility for the next generation. So thank you very much for listening to me. I'd love to have a discussion and take your questions if you've got any.
Thanks very much, Patrick. That was fantastic. So much wonderful information and ideas and inspiration in there. I personally really enjoyed it, and I'm sure everybody who's participating did as well. Just wanted to come back to a few things, but while I do, I'd really encourage all participants to maybe submit any questions that they have. I know we've got a few great farmers out there tonight, and I'd particularly love to hear from the farmers. We've got Gerard Walsh from Galway and Boyd Bryce from Donegal, great farmer Jim Cronin here in Clare, Michael Davern, Melissa Youngkin. There's a few wonderful farmers here. I'd love to hear their response to what you have to say. One thing, Patrick, I come from a farming family in Waterford as well, and I'm just curious as to how do you fit it all in? Farming is such a full-time job, and your enterprise is multifaceted, including the marketing dimension. Where do you find the time to engage in all these additional ideas and organizations and work that you do, the advocacy work, the thought that you put into it? How do you reconcile the two activities?
Well, sometimes with difficulty, obviously. My typical week is probably 3 or 4 days on the farm, and before COVID, possibly the other way around, you know, 3 or 4 days away and 2 or 3 days on the farm. My wife, Becky, is very involved with the farm. She's doing all the record keeping. She's also become more and more competent. She's looking after the cheese dairy, and she milks and does more or less everything these days. So that's wonderful. We also have three people currently working in the cheese dairy and a couple of people working on the farm. But I know what you mean. It's sort of like, I'm not sure if it's the right metaphor, but it's like being a conductor, isn't it, being a farmer? You have to have the ache of urgency when you need to. You have to be across everything. You have to almost know intuitively when something is going wrong. You need to sort of cast your eye over the animals. And over time, it's amazing what you can know, the incredible, you know, it's as if you can douse what's happening with an animal over time. But, of course, the truth is we get things wrong. We're not always on the ball. And I guess there is a cost to being absent from a farm. But it's something, I suppose, the flip side of that is that I believe that too much of what is happening in agriculture is designed by people who don't farm. And I think there needs to be a shift towards really valuing practitioners. I think if we're going to redesign agricultural policy, it should be practitioners who design it. And if we're going to advise a whole generation of farmers to shift their methods, it should be the farmers that advise them, not, you know, consultants and policy wonks and academics. Don't get me wrong, I'm not being critical of people like that, but I feel that they have paid too little respect to the deep knowledge of practitioners.
I think that's a hugely important point myself. I think a lot of there's a lot of science and a lot of policy, but I think the voice of the farmer in terms of designing and implementing some of these programs is sadly lacking. But just another quick question on a personal level, Patrick, do you find having to run a farm is it makes all your other work more difficult, or does it inform the other work that you do, the advocacy work and the work?
I think it's absolutely the latter. All my best thoughts are having, you know, squeezing shit or milking cows or whatever, you know. I mean, I'm fed by nature and by the animals and just by the sheer joy of being closely involved with physical work. A guy, actually Prince Charles's farm manager, David, wonderful man called David Wilson, he once said, meaningful physical work is such a premium these days. And it's true, you know, we go down to the gym or we, you know, have to build into our lives an exercise regime. If we work with our bodies, which is what the human body was designed to do, we have better thoughts and we're more integrated between our heads and our bodies and our emotions. And surely that is what the harmonious development of human beings is all about. So I thank God that I've become involved with practical agriculture.
I think it's a great point. And I think, Patrick, in terms of what you say and what you advocate, it gives you added legitimacy, given that
definitely,
you are practicing
farming. Definitely. Farmers can tell. Farmers are very intelligent and acute. And they can tell if somebody is speaking from knowledge of experience or just theory.
Patrick, can I ask you from a layman's point of view? There's a dominant narrative out there that in order to feed our growing population on the planet, that we need intensive agriculture. And I think in order to bring out that revolutionary change that you're talking about in public opinion, I think that's the argument that's going to have to be dealt with.
I agree.
How much truth is in it, and what argument would you use to tackle
that? Well, it's such an important point. Did you watch the David Attenborough Extinction Program on Netflix?
Not yet, no.
Well, you should watch it. Because it's a completely, it's rather a devastating program. And at the end, he basically, you know, says, we haven't got long. And then he says, don't worry, there's things we can do. And then he goes through, you know, we need to move away from fossil fuels to renewable energy and we need to rewild. So he's on the rewilding side. And then he gets to food. And I think he gets it completely wrong. He says we need to do what the Dutch are doing and do hydroponics in greenhouses and kind of tech stuff. And he said, you know, the Dutch are the second largest exporters of food in the world, and we need to copy them and learn from them. And I think he just doesn't get agriculture. And I know that sounds a very sort of disparaging thing to say about a national treasure, but I think he is genuinely ignorant about agriculture. And I know this because I have a note in my office in Bristol, a handwritten note, which I got from him 2 weeks ago. I wrote to him and asked him if he would do a podcast with me. And he wrote a charming little note back and said, I'm sorry, I don't know enough about agriculture to talk to you. So I think, you know, David Attenborough is in a kind of focus group for us all. We don't understand agriculture, and therefore we don't know how to use our buying power to buy ourselves into a better future. And if David Attenborough doesn't know, we can excuse ourselves for not knowing either. So I think in that programme, the end of the Extinction programme, he just read a script, which was probably the BBC Natural History Unit switch, because they've been drinking the kind of techie people's Kool-Aid as well. And it's just not right. And of course, that leads to another question. Could we feed the world if we farm more in harmony with nature? And I think we could, because we waste half the food we produce. But you know, between the farm and the fridge and the throwaway, 50% of the food that's grown never gets eaten. Also, we eat industrial chicken and pork and dairy products from mega dairies. We have to stop eating those products, and we have to switch to grass-fed animals. And we need to regard chicken as a treat, pasture-fed chicken with a little bit of grain as an occasional treat, not the staple. So we'll have to change our diets. And what we ought to eat, say in Wales or in Ireland, is we need to eat what the farmers of our country produce when they're farming in regenerative ways and in those proportions. So if Ireland produces a lot of delicious grass-fed beef and lamb and not much chicken, that's what we should eat in those ratios. And of course we can eat vegetables. We should also eat a lot more vegetables, but we need to link it to the production in our in the place where we live.
And what do you think is blocking that happening? Because you go to the supermarket and the organic products are actually getting cheaper and cheaper. You don't know where they're coming from. And of course, there's no link to sustainability. What is stopping farmers from marketing goods that you market in that way, that they're coming from these farms?
You're 100% right. And the reason why these vegetables are getting cheaper and cheaper is because they're grown in organic monocultures on a vast scale in the eastern counties on fields that have never seen an animal. And an animal manure is, you know, it's an enlivener of the soil. It's full of bacteria, and it's like a pump primer for soil fertility and taste and flavor. And the reason why even the organic vegetables don't taste very much these days is partly varieties, but it's also the farming systems. It's sort of token organicness and not the real thing in my view. And so because we don't know that, we just carry on buying what they've got on their shelves. And I just did a podcast with a woman from Morrison's, and she more or less said, our customers trust us, so we're choice editing for them. So we need to become much better informed about what's wrong. And I think we need to go into our local supermarket and have this prescription, say, go to a supermarket and only buy food from that supermarket if you know who produced it, whether it's sustainably or regeneratively or organically produced, and where they came from. And if you can't find food which meets that buying prescription, don't buy it, or go to the customer service desk and say, sorry, it's not good enough. And then those guys will tell the board or whoever the directors are, and they'll have to think about it. And unless we do that, we're just going to get on carrying on getting food, which is actually damaging our health. And that's what's happening at the moment. We're living in a global feeding trial where we've industrialized our farming. We're feeding the whole population highly processed food from industrial agriculture. We've got no control, but look at all the diseases which are becoming more and more prevalent now. Diabetes, obesity, cancers. Food intolerances have gone crazy these days. Diseases of the, you know, the evidence is there.
Anjali, I might just interject there. We have a lot of questions, and we've got a few panelists I want to bring in, but a bit selfishly, I wanted to ask you one more question, Patrick. When you spoke about the barriers, there was just two other barriers in my mind that I'd just like you to respond to or consider maybe. Do you think there is the willingness within the farming community to make the changes, the type of change you're describing? We had a very interesting talk last night from Rob Burton about this notion of the good farmer and what it means within the community to be a good farmer, which means to be very progressive and, you know, producing beautiful pedigree animals and beautiful clean pastures and so on. That's one thing, the willingness to change. And the second thing is, do you think there's a knowledge gap in terms of the how do we farm in that regenerative way? Is there skills issues around it? Is there enough advice on how to do that? We have advice on intensive beef and dairy. Is there enough advice on how to farm in this regenerative way?
No, I don't think there is. And I think you are right to identify this as a barrier to change, because I still think the education system which informs young farmers today, and all the propaganda and the magazines, most of the farming magazines, is predicated on the idea that if you get bigger and if you're more kind of efficient in that way, which moves genetics and yield and all the things that, you know, people admire in the farming community, tend to admire, that's the role model. And this idea that we should not necessarily get bigger, not necessarily chase yields, but instead of chase nutrient density and food quality and cultural aspects and quality of life, is not mainstream. And the education system is still churning out farmers who are chipped to do that kind of thing. But I think there's a counter stream running. I think if you asked most farmers, if we did like a national survey, all the farmers in Ireland, if you felt you could make as much money farming in harmony with nature, rebuilding the wildlife, producing more nutrient-dense food and selling that food into local markets, if you could make a sufficient income doing that, which would you rather do? I think the majority of farmers would be very happy to switch, but the whole system is geared to them becoming commodity slaves, supplying these big food companies and retailers, and they're trapped on the treadmill of intensification. And if we want to get off it, you're right, we have to retrain and rechip all the farming community with a different worldview, and that's going to take time, but I think it needs to be done, and I think it can be done. I just think that it's like animals that know when the tsunami is coming. We all know that something really bleak is right ahead of us now, and we want to be part of the solution. And the truth is, farming has been part of the problem, and it could be part of the solution.
Fantastic answer. I'm going to take a couple of questions and maybe invite in, just on the policy front, Gwyn Jones, who's well known here and a neighbour of yours, lives about 3 miles from you. And Gwyn says, it strikes me that in our area, the biodiversity is sadly almost inversely proportional to the seriousness of the farm. I hope you're right about the Welsh Government's approach, but when I read their still very vague proposals, I really fear that they'll turn into a tick list, which will just enable the money to go roughly where it's going already, with the same consequences. What makes you so confident that this ain't so?
Well, he's not wrong about the biodiversity. You know, I mean, the most efficient farms, I can think of some, but I won't name them, round here, are probably having the most destructive effect on biodiversity. And it's also true that the most, you know, knowledgeable and kind of progressive farmers are best at harvesting the subsidies. And there's no doubt. Well, I think the National Farmers Union of Wales, the leadership of the National Farmers Union of Wales, is a guy called John Davis. He gets all this stuff. I think there will be a battle when the new Welsh farming scheme is launched, because I think the, quote, progressive farmers who have intensified, who think that they're doing the best thing and they're leading the rest of the farming community, will push back hard. And I just hope that the Welsh government holds its nerve, because it is unforgivable that farmers should be rewarded for using practices which are causing, directly contributing to climate change, biodiversity loss, river pollution, and damage to public health. I know these farmers are efficient, and I don't blame them. They're following the money. So let's change the way the money comes to them. I believe most of them will respond. But he's not wrong about how serious the situation is at the moment.
Thank you very much. And I might just ask for a little input here from a colleague, James Moran. James has had his hand raised. So James, do you want to unmute and come in there?
Yeah. I'm very interested in the policy angle, and particularly in most of Europe, we're on the juggernaut that is the common agricultural policy. And we've seen in the debate in the council and in the parliament in the last week in particular, how difficult it is to make any changes to that. I'm really interested in what's going to happen with Brexit, because he seemed to have just thrown a lifeboat over the edge, all jumped in. But totally unsure of which direction you're sailing in, you know. And if you sail in the right direction, I'm sure the juggernaut will just turn tail and chase after you, you know. But it's, so at the moment, I see this as a lot of debate in across Britain on this payment for public goods.
Yes.
Totally unsure about how you're going to implement it. So you see your role as farmers as food security, paying for the produce, also paying for these public goods through public money. But then in the trade policy, if you open up trade and go against to world prices totally, then no matter how much you pay for the public goods, you know, the whole system is going to collapse in on itself, you know.
Absolutely.
So I think it was James Rebanks that mentioned that maybe you need to go back to more protectionist policy to sort of maintain the markets and then the paying for public goods. So, and
yes,
we do a lot of work on trying to come up with scoring systems that actually rewards and pays for the results. And we'd be very much interested if it works out the way you're talking about in Wales, that you take a more holistic approach and pay for more public goods and the sustainability based on a simplified scorecard system for the entire farm across a range of public goods. I think this could be a seller for us all. How do we get away from this world market? And this is it's totally confused. Like, one won't work without the other. And you're saying you want payment for public goods and then open up for free trade at world prices.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Everything you said, I agree with. And that it's horrible to watch all these amendments to the Agriculture Bill and the House of Lords being thrown back out by Boris's majority in the House of Commons. What we really need the government to do, and we're working on this for the COP26, but we haven't yet rechipped Boris. But I think there's a lot of people thinking this way, is that instead of capitulating in the trade agreement with America, for instance, in order to get other goods imported, what the UK should do at the COP26 is say, we need to lead the launch of a new global system for trade in food, and only food from which is not causing climate change or biodiversity loss and is leading to soil regeneration should be traded without any tariffs. So free trade for genuine sustainably produced food. That means we have to measure it. So we need to have a harmonized framework for measuring sustainability, which every country in the world adopts. And then food produced to lower standards, which of course is the chlorinated chicken argument, that should be have tariffs imposed on it. I should be banned altogether, and that is protectionism, a healthy form of protectionism. Yeah. Or people should pay a tariff for the environmental costs, production costs related to the lower quality food that they want to export. And that's like turning the whole thing on its head, and it could be like a Paris Agreement for trade in food. And interestingly enough, if Biden gets in, I'm not holding out that, you know, I'm not saying he's going to completely change everything. But the woman who is responsible for negotiating the trade deal on behalf of the Americans in London was appointed under the Obama administration. And she is enlightened. I mean, she's only a civil servant, but she gets this stuff. And I think there's a hell of a lot of people out there who would like to see a trade deal like that brokered.
That's very interesting, because that moves away from this nationalist protectionist policy, which is seen as poor, to this sort of environment and society protectionist, which could be seen as a workable global protectionism, you know.
Yes. But
the thing that drove the Brexit and the exit from the EU was a nationalism. And I don't even think that what you've said there is on the agenda whatsoever.
It's not. And it's really sad. I don't know if you know this. I did a podcast with Stanley, Boris Johnson's dad, a couple of months ago, and he's passionately in favour of the EU, and it's such an ironic thing that I'm not even sure that Boris even believes in Brexit. He just thought it was going away for political advancement, but he was tapping into this anger that a lot of people felt, Middle Britain, and I think that's the point, that Boris got elected with a kind of equivalent of Trumpist kind of people who were exercising a protest vote. And unless those Middle Britain people, the people who elect governments in all countries really, better understand the crucial central importance of food and the relationship between food, between their health and the health of the planet, we're not going to get the change we need, even if we get a couple of enlightened politicians. So I think it's a big mountain to climb, but I think the force is with us, because I think there's an arising of awareness about this, and what people lack is good information. they're utterly confused. I mean, this whole vegan vegetarian thing, you can't blame young people for saying, I'm not going to have anything to do with industrial meat, because it's, they don't know what else to do. They don't realize that there is a different kind of meat.
Yeah.
So we have to educate them.
Thanks, Patrick. I'd like to cut in there and ask you some of the questions coming in from our attendees. Patricia McKee has asked, what do you think is the future role of women in this type of farming?
I think that women are reconciling, emotionally intelligent. They lack some of the unfortunate afflictions of the males of the species. And I think that women can play a central role in this transition. I think we need the energy of all the female principals to permeate some of the men who have been in charge. And I think this is an enormous opportunity for women to play a centrally important role in the transition we need. And that can be on farms, but also obviously in political sphere as well. So yeah, the whole principle of harmonious development needs a more emotionally strong element to it, it seems to me, and more compassion. And those values and elements are so strong, in so much stronger in most women than men.
That's right, we need to see more women out there.
Definitely.
Yeah. Bridget Barry has asked, Patrick, what is your one nature hack that you would give for all farmers to make change?
Well, it's very hard to know exactly, just, you know, in which field. I mean, that's really,
I think,
can she ask a little bit more?
I think it's in the sense of, on your farm, is there one thing that you did above all others which really you felt benefited nature? I think you did mention the pond before as being a really good nature hack. Build a pond.
Well, I mean, there's one thing that I think is, this sounds just as if this is kind of like organic thing, but I do think if you're going to change one thing in terms of practice, it would be to try to phase out the dependency on nitrogen fertilizer, because I think the use of nitrogen fertilizer is right at the root of all the ills of modern agriculture. I'll just give a list. It increases production. A farmer's worst enemy is overproduction. It diminishes soil biology. It burns up soil carbon. It produces rapid watery growth, which makes the plants more vulnerable to fungus, pest, and weed problems. Weeds, because you grow long arable crops. Then the chemists come in and you need the pesticides, the herbicides, the fungicides to control all this imbalance. If you stop using nitrogen fertilizer, if we tax nitrogen fertilizer according to the true damage it's doing to the climate change and everything, then farmers would have to change their systems. They'd have to go back to mixed farming, which was prevalent even in West Wales, probably just until up to the Second World War. So I think that the whole thing is driven by the incredible productivity, apparent productivity, that nitrogen fertilizer has brought farming, but it's come at a terrible cost.
Do you think there are subsidies going to these fertilizer producers that if they were cut, that it would naturally become unprofitable to use fertilizers? Would that?
The European Nitrogen Assessment has done a study looking at the damage. If you buy, let's say, a kilogram of nitrogen fertilizer, let's say it costs €1, it doesn't matter what a farmer puts it on the land, they get a crop yield increase, which nets them €2 or €3. So there's a business case for using nitrogen fertilizer. But the European Nitrogen Assessment, a couple of hundred scientists, they did a study on the monetized negative externalities, in other words, the damage done to the environment and public health by the use of that kilogram of nitrogen, and worked out what that would be if it was taxed according to that damage. Turns out it would wipe out the profit. So if nitrogen users were financially responsible for the cost of damage that the nitrogen is doing, it would wipe out the business case for its use. But nitrogen fertilizer hasn't been taxed. It's like aircraft fuel. Why not? Because prime ministers and governments think that cheap food is kind of pacifying the masses. And if they took action to put the price of food up, then they get revolt in the streets. Yet we're already paying for the damage that nitrogen is doing in hidden ways. So this is really sad. And we need, you know, riots in the streets to introduce a tax on nitrogen fertilizer. I haven't seen that happening yet, but I do think we need it.
Thanks, Patrick. Just the last question in that line. Where do you recommend farmers get resources on developing ideas around regenerative farming?
I think the best farmers should be the beacon farms to teach the rest of the farming community. So I think if I was the Irish Minister of Agriculture, I would say, let's identify the best regenerative farms in Ireland, whether they're organic or agricultural, it doesn't matter what the label is, the farmers who are best using methods which are farming in harmony with nature, coexisting with biodiversity, building soil, producing nutrient-dense food, let's pay them to be educators. So let's enable them to welcome other farmers to learn from them, spread the knowledge that way. A guy in India did that in the state of Andhra Pradesh, and he basically has now a million smallholder farmers practicing those kind of methods. And he had the choice of hiring advisors, and he said, no, I don't want to hire advisors, I want to go to the farmers. And I think that's what we should do.
I think that's a fantastic answer, Patrick. And it's a cue in to a little plug from ourselves. We set up a little initiative called Farming for Nature a couple of years ago. I know Bridget Barry, who coordinates that, is on the call as well tonight. But that was an effort to identify farmers across Ireland who are doing great things for nature on their farms, and to celebrate those farmers, and for those farmers to show other farmers what they do and maybe inspire those farmers. Because I think there's an authenticity to a farmer telling another farming peer what he does, how he does it, and what are the implications. Yeah. So I think there's a beautiful awards night on tomorrow night where our female Minister of Agriculture is going to be talking to some of those farmers. So that's a nice cue.
Right. Does she get this stuff?
What?
Does she get this stuff?
Absolutely. She does. I think certainly does. And one of those farmers from last year, actually, Gerard Walsh, has a question here tonight, because, and I think it's quite a good one, it's relating to marginal farms. So I guess the hillier farms, wetland farms. What's your view of the place of marginal farms and hill farms that can't turn the same economic output as on good land like yours, but often have a much greater richness of nature? I suppose somewhere along already the road of rewilded landscapes to some degree.
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. It's hard. If we're going to reward farmers for sustainability outcomes, then one of those rewards should be for increasing biodiversity. But we also need to produce some food, I think. Otherwise, we have really got a problem. And so there needs to be a balance struck, in my view, between rewilding some bits of farms, I guess, especially the less productive areas, but also maintaining at the same time more managed bits of the land, which can be good grassland, for instance, and with mixed grazing systems can produce remarkably good food, albeit at a lower stocking rate. So I think that the people who are designing the agricultural support systems need to create a framework which is applicable to farmers in more marginal areas, upland areas, because those places shouldn't just be rewilded, I don't think. I think humans are part of nature and there needs to be some sort of coexistence. I've been to Romania quite a few times and there's an amazing coexistence of small farmers, still with horse economies actually, in Transylvania, in the pristine forests where they clear sections and they graze herds of cattle and sheep, and it's beautiful.
I'm really glad that you brought that up and Jared's question as well, because really that's the foundation of a lot of the work that we've been doing in the Burren, recognizing that
yes,
it's not one or the other, it's both. No. That farming systems and meat production in places like the Burren, which have huge cultural and biodiversity value, have a place in modern agriculture, both in terms of food production and other ecosystem services.
Yes, and the most vital food we'll ever eat will come from those places, you know, because it's wilder. You know, it'll be more vital.
The trick is to capture that added value in the price and the price of the consumer case. And you mentioned before, Patrick, about this notion of rewarding people for delivering ecosystem services. We did introduce a scoring system in the Burren about 10 years ago. And the higher the score, the better your environmental outcomes and the more money you get paid. It's worked really well. But I'd like to bring in another panelist, Sharon Parr, who's at the meeting. And Sharon would have been the architect, I guess, of that scoring system. Sharon, I don't know, do you have anything to say in response to what you've heard tonight from Patrick? Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, very thought-provoking, as often happens. I'm not sure so many of these things were not already taught to the converted, which has implications going forward. We're not talking, we feel like we're talking on behalf of the whole population, and I don't think we really are. One of the things we've been talking about is changing farming. But the trouble is, and even came out here, was you stopped growing carrots because the supermarket got rid of the packing station. You told us that we should go to the supermarkets and ask for sort of sustainably produced food or regeneratively grown food. If I went to the supermarket and waited for that, I'd be starved. If I went to the farm shop down the road, I could do that. So in tandem with changing potentially summer farming, do we also need to look at changing how food is retailed? Is there too much reliance totally. On the supermarkets? How do we move away from that? I mean, you even said yourself, organic food in supermarkets is becoming cheaper because it's now being mass produced. It's not really following the principles of organics. How do you actually break through when the retailers and the supermarket systems are so strong?
Yeah, what a great question. I just want to say something first before I address that, which is that I think we've got a lot to learn from your scoring system. One of the things we're grappling with at the moment is how we measure farm biodiversity. And we've divided it into two categories: agricultural biodiversity, which is like the livestock that you have and the breeds of plants that you use and all that kind of thing. And then the non-agricultural biodiversity, the species which are plants and small mammals and birds and insects and everything which can coexist with the farming system. But we're still struggling to get a set of metrics which are kind of usable by a normal farmer that would enable us to capture those impacts, if you see what I mean. But to your point about food system redesign, I think it's actually got to be part of it. I think that all the infrastructure that used to exist around here for getting food to local markets has disappeared while I've been farming here. We're just very lucky we've got a small abattoir nearby, but a lot of the small dairies and all the kind of local marketing outlets have gone. But I think there is a shift now. There's a lot of interest in farmers markets and in small shops stocking local food. And I think that's got to be taken to the next level. Of course, online stuff is flourishing during COVID. So there are green shoots of hope about decentralized marketing starting to emerge. And I think if we start to tax farming systems which are industrial and intensive, that will make them less profitable. And then it will help the stronger emergence of alternative local food distribution systems. But it is more or less a reconstruction exercise, I have to admit.
Thanks for that response. And in terms of advising on that challenge of capturing biodiversity outcomes, I think you're probably speaking to a couple of the leading people in Ireland, in Sharon and James there tonight. So we're very happy to help you in that front.
We'd love to work with you.
Fantastic. A question from another wonderful and very inspiring farmer, Jim Cronin, for you, Patrick. Jim's just wondering, Jim's a market farmer here in County Clare, wondering if you have tried minimal cultivation in the establishment of your oat mix.
Well, that's a very topical question because we've been using ploughing, and I'm a sort of believer in shallow ploughing, which is not terribly bad in a high rainfall area where weed control is very difficult if you just use Mintil. But there's a guy who does the ploughing for us who had just bought a machine which I think would be perfect for the arable silage, which we'll be planting in the fields we grew oats and peas in this year, which will just be a one-pass machine, which is kind of a Mintil drill, you know, cultivator combined, which looked pretty promising to me. So I do think we need to try to do less soil inversion and also save energy. And I'm sure the technology is coming along for that. But I don't think that Roundup should play any part in any of this. I think that's another addiction that I think is dangerous, the addiction to Roundup. I mean, around us, there's a lot of field, a lot of farmers are just spraying all their grass end off with Roundup and then direct drilling into it. And some farmers are even spraying Roundup onto silage crops and then ensiling them, and then spraying Roundup on cereal crops as a pre-harvest desiccant, and then harvesting them 5 or 10 days later is really common. And that means that Roundup residues are getting into our food, and Roundup is a carcinogen. So I think we do need to move towards Mintil, but not umbilically linked to the use of Roundup.
Okay. Thanks for that response, Patrick. Can I ask a kind of a very obvious and stupid question, but maybe it's on other people's minds and not just my own. I know you're previously very involved in organic farming, but now the buzzword seems to be regenerative farming. Could you offer us, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of farmers, we have 137,000 of them in Ireland, and they're wondering, well, am I regenerative or am I not, or what is that? Could you give us a kind of simple explanation, Patrick, to your understanding of the term?
I haven't turned my back on organic farming. We're still certified to the Soil Association. We're actually the longest established organic dairy farm in Wales now. But nor do I think that regenerative is the only word to use. You know, a lot of people have referred to agroecological farming and sustainable farming and biodynamic farming, of course. I think what we need to do is we need to design a system of measuring the impact of farming, which includes all farmers, so that it's like, instead of saying you're organic and you're not, or you're regenerative and you're not, we're on a kind of like an incremental scale measuring the impacts of the farming system. And it's like a stairway to heaven. It's not you're bad and you're good. It's what are you doing this year, which is going to improve your biodiversity outcomes over last year. So I think we need to reframe it. And of course, we need to have market thresholds. So, you know, you could say, let's supposing the sustainability audit that I'm doing on my farm has 100 points maximum score, and I'm 61. Well, I want to be 64 next year. And the Soil Association might say, well, I can say to them, here's my data, or the Irish Trust, the Organic Trust, or IOFCA. You give them the data and you say, well, here's my sustainability score. You might want to ask me a couple of supplementary questions, but don't send an inspector to spend 2 days seeing if I'm cheating, because I'm going to fill in my sustainability return. If I falsify the records, I'm breaking the law. Then you decide whether I can get organic certification, and that should be much cheaper, and it won't involve replication of inspections. So I think that what's in a word, we can use all these words, but we need to define them more accurately with data.
Yeah, I think it can be very understandable. A quick question on that's quite an interesting system you described. Would you limit it to environmental indicators, or would you include social indicators in terms of the sustainability picture?
Definitely social indicators. We worked on that. So one of the categories in our metrics, for which we develop metrics, is the social development and dimension. So you could say nutrition per acre is a better model in terms of public health, or you could say we need an education element and we need to encourage visitors to the farm. And you could develop metrics which would capture the degree of cultural and social contribution that the farm makes. And also employment is human capital. So that's a social benefit. Absolutely. So I think we need those metrics as well, and they need to be integrated into the system. And that's what we're doing.
I have one last question, yeah. Brendan. Patrick, in terms of the products you produce on your farm, where do most of your profits come from? How did you link to your markets? What are your main markets?
Well, that's a challenging question as well. We have, I know that in Irish terms, that's relatively large dairy herd of 80 cows, but basically we're a vanishing species, small family dairy farms. And the only way we manage to survive at all is by adding value to the milk on the farm, producing cheese. And the cheese, depending on your view, is reassuringly expensive or otherwise out of reach of normal people who want to buy cheese in a supermarket. So it's a bit ironic that we've ended up sending our cheese, in some cases, very long distances from the farm, even to other countries, when in an ideal world, we'd like to sell it locally. And I think the price point of our cheese would get more accessible if we did some of the things that I was suggesting in my talk. But mostly our cheese is sold on its story. So people are buying it because they know that our farming system is in harmony with nature. We love our cows and we're kind to them. We're trying to address climate change and all those things. Not many people, weirdly enough, buy our cheese because it's organic. Although if it was carrots, we were still growing it, they probably would buy them because there's a better sort of understanding of that. So I think direct marketing, as was said by the last question, we need to sell with less links in the chain. I think supermarkets are on the decline, especially big ones that are doing centralized buying. I hope they are anyway. And I think we need to have a more close personal relationship with our customers and sell the story of our food.
So what will make your cheese cheaper for us to buy, for example?
That's a really good question. If I got more agricultural subsidies in the Welsh government, if we got more efficient What do I mean by that? Just better at farming, I guess. Maybe greater scale, but I don't really want to become a very large cheesemaker. Maybe what we're trying to do is sell our price, our food, at the true price. And I think what we've got to do, most food we buy is dishonestly priced, if we're honest, because it doesn't bear all this hidden cultural and environmental costs. So I think we've got to correct those distortions and then pay the true price of our food. In the 70s, people spent 30% of their disposable income on food. Today, it's under 10%. That will probably have to change.
So what you're saying is we need to pay the amount that you're charging for your cheese, or that's what you're saying?
Probably.
And probably paying too little for the other stuff you're buying instead.
I'm afraid so. Yeah, that sounds unpalatable, but yes. But we're already paying in hidden ways. We're paying in health treatment costs, pollution cleanup. You know, we're paying in different ways. They're hidden from us.
Listen, I think it's time to close.
Yes.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed that hour and a half, Patrick. After a long, long week, I found that actually really refreshing and hugely enjoyable and very stimulating. I think you're a master communicator. You've got an incredible range of experience and great vision as well, importantly, and a hunger to pursue that vision. So I think it's been a real privilege to hear from you tonight, and you've greatly enhanced the school. It's a pity we weren't here in person. We could show you around, and but another time, hopefully.
So I'd love to come.
Please do, Patrick. You'd be welcome anytime. So it's been a privilege and a pleasure, and I wish everybody a lovely Friday evening. Thank you very much.